Hello, I'm Richard Adie. This is Best Practice. It's a new program on RM which focuses on work and management. Work's a huge part of life, and if you're lucky, it's engaging and fulfilling. Sometimes it's frustrating and exhausting. It can be overwhelming. What you really don't want it to be is boring. What you do or what you did is part of your identity. It's important. And management, well, unless you're a manager, you probably don't appreciate them very much. But this stuff is difficult. It's getting people to do things they might not want to do. Management is complex and a discipline in itself. And Best Practice will try to keep you up to speed. So let's get going. Earlier this week, former Army Chief David Morrison was made Australian of the Year because of his work on gender equity. Juliet Burke, who's a partner at Deloitte, says his appointment will have a real impact in corporate Australia.
I think it lifts the conversation of gender diversity to a new level, and it was already at a peak. We've been on a journey about this in Australia since 2010 with the Australian Stock Exchange guidelines around gender diversity. We've had the Male Champions of Change. Now, with David being Australian of the Year, there's a newer energy around it again.
It's kind of an exclamation point.
It is.
I can see that as somebody who's not in your business, but especially after Rosie Batty being last year, she was such a passionate advocate against domestic violence. Following that up with someone who's got it for work in gender equity, it's really kind of underlining something, isn't it?
And particularly coming from David, a very passionate man, he's very effective, he's powerful, great communicator, and he has reshaped an institution that was seemingly intractable. So the attention-grabbing moment that it's David Morrison who is the Australian of the Year in relation to gender equity, who else would you pick to make that statement and take attention to a new level?
Well, he's made it clear he'll be putting the spotlight on domestic violence, but also diversity and the gender pay gap. How much attention will be being paid to him doing that in sort of professional Australia?
Well, he has been one of the Male Champions of Change, this small group of body of men who started up in 2010. There was about 10 of them. It was auspiced by the Sex Discrimination Commissioner. And that has now been joined by many, many more CEOs within Australia and public sector. There's been spin-offs of that. The sort of Property Council now has a Male Champions of Change. So there's already this groundswell amongst the leadership within Australia. All this is doing now is taking that conversation broader to people who perhaps had missed it, to people who don't really see it as a central issue in terms of Australia's economic prosperity. And taking it broader means it brings a new wave of energy to it.
What about the rest of it? Because diversity is something he mentioned, and he's already spoken about religious discrimination in Australia. Is that something that's going to resonate too?
I think it is. I think so. David's journey around this was definitely one of thinking about gender diversity and then going broader and thinking about inclusion. And obviously that goes to sexual orientation, it goes to religion, it goes to economic status, it goes to gender, it goes to race, all of those things.
So with his appointment, this is a government appointment, obviously, is this an example of business and other workplaces taking its cue from government? Or is this a kind of moment in Australian history?
I think it's been a coalition, really, between the government and corporate Australia, because the Male Champions of Change comprise both members of government as well as corporate. So that was already on the table. And I think that's been an interesting partnership. And actually, it just comes down to individual people, these diversity champions, wanting to change the culture that they lead, wanting to leave their footprint, or create a better legacy with their footprint, let me say it like that. For David to be the one that was selected, it actually reflects him as the crucible of corporate Australia and government coming together around an issue that is about Australia's sense of self. It is about our people and innovation and prosperity.
All right. I want to ask you about something else now, because it is the time of year where a lot of people have had a break. I've had a break. And most people are now pretty much back at work. I know you've looked at this. How does having a break affect how we regard work?
It gives us that precious moment of reflection when the busyness of the day-to-day, the distractions and the, you know, taking you off path is swept away and peeled back is that question you ask yourself, am I doing the right thing? Am I doing something that gives me a sense of meaning and purpose? And when you recalibrate in that moment, you know, there's a number of options in front of you. You know, yes, it's a confirmation, keep going forward, makes sense to me. Or else it's a, you know, that New Year's resolution, actually I'm going to take myself into a different direction. And if you are going on the right path for you, it's energizing. So it gives you that moment to keep on going.
This is a whole other conversation. I hope we get you back. Thanks for joining me today.
Pleasure.
Juliet Burke is a partner at Deloitte, where she works in diversity, inclusion and leadership. This is Best Practice on RN, online and on the pod. I'm Richard Adie. Why do you work? Now, you might say, it's because I haven't won Powerball yet, but it's probably more complicated than that. Barry Schwartz from Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania considers this very question in his book, Why We Work.
There's a kind of ideology that dominates our culture, your culture and mine and most others, that the only reason people work is to get paid, that people basically are lazy. If they had their way, they would sit on a couch eating chips and watching sports. But we have to make a living, so we go to work. And I would suspect that if you asked most people, why do you work, they'd say something like that. Well, what do you mean, why do I work? I have to get paid. But I think this really sells human beings very short, because people care about not only that they get paid, but also what they do. They want to do work that's engaging, that's challenging, that has variety, that where they have some discretion and control over what they do. And most important, they want to do work that has meaning, that in some way or other, small or large, makes the world a better place.
All right. Let me kind of pull a bit of that apart. You're not saying that we're not motivated by money, because clearly we are.
How motivated we are by money depends on what else is available to us in the workplace. When you create workplaces on the model that the only reason people work is to get paid, you tend to create workplaces that nobody wants to be at except for a paycheck. Assembly line factories, call centers where every call has to end in whatever it is, 2 minutes. Office jobs where every keystroke you make is monitored. If you have jobs like that, the only reason to do them is to get paid. But why are jobs constructed like that? They are constructed like that because we've essentially adopted this ideology that as long as you're paying people, it doesn't matter what they do.
So you would agree that we mostly wouldn't work if we didn't get paid, but that it isn't enough.
That's correct.
All right.
And not only that it's not enough, but I'd go further than that. It's often not the most important thing.
But there are plenty of people who choose their careers precisely because of how much they will be paid.
I think you're absolutely right about that, and it's heartbreaking that it's true. And the people who make that decision tend to be extremely dissatisfied with their work, so that their grotesque compensation is a kind of consolation prize. They don't stay in that line of work for very long. They're looking for something more because they have, you know, fancy material things and a kind of emptiness inside. Now, is this true of everybody who takes a job like that? Absolutely not.
All right. Well, how did we get here, Barry? Because you've mentioned a couple of times now we're kind of this philosophy has pushed it this way.
I went back in the book to Adam Smith, since Adam Smith is the father of modern economics. And in his classic book, The Wealth of Nations, which he published in 1776, almost 250 years ago, he says people are lazy, and unless you make it worth their while, they'll do nothing. And if you make it worth their while, they'll do whatever it is you want them to do. And as long as that's true, why not organize work so that it's maximally efficient, that it doesn't take a lot of skill? You divide the labor up. Everybody has some small task to perform and performs it over and over and over again all day long. And as long as they're being paid, they'll be happy to show up at work, and you end up with a much more efficient system of production, and the result is an increase in social in material wealth for society. So he said that in 1776, and over the next century, we essentially built an economy in that image.
Yeah, you quote the example that he uses, which is about being in a pin factory.
Yes.
How if you had five different guys making pins, they could maybe make a few dozen each a day. But if you, I suppose, break down the job, then they can make many, 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 many more. And that it does sound like a terrible job, though, it has to be said, any one of them.
Yeah, and, you know, another thing that makes it terrible is that prior to the factory, life was not easy for people before the beginning of industrialization. But what a typical person did in the course of a day was varied from day to day and from hour to hour. There were many tasks, and, you know, maintaining the plot, taking care of the animals, whatever it was. And the worker was in charge of himself. And his work was integrated into the rest of his life. He worked at home or nearby, and he didn't go off into this building to do his work. But with the advent of the factory, you not only routinized work, but you also separated it spatially and temporally. You separated work from everything else that was a part of that person's life. And I think the result was a real impoverishment of people's attitude toward labor.
So that's the rise of the factory, and I suppose the industrial mine and things like that too, because we have, you know, we have crafts and skills that have given us some of the names that people have that go back centuries that were not so routine and that took years to learn and master. Those jobs have been affected by the Industrial Revolution, but they were around before.
They were around before, and I'm not disputing that a factory produces things more efficiently. There's a great example from much more modern times when Toyota took over a General Motors manufacturing plant in Southern California. It was the worst automobile factory in the world, at least in the United States, probably in the world.
Yeah.
And Toyota took it over because they wanted a foothold in the American market, and they thought they needed a domestic factory to make that happen. And they implemented the Toyota system of production, which is an assembly line, but it's an assembly line where anybody on the line can stop the line if they see something that's gone wrong. So people are authorized to take charge, every one of them. And here's the amazing thing. The same employees who were working in the worst automobile plant in the world became employees in the best automobile plant in the United States as a result of the transition from the American mode of manufacturing to the Toyota system. So even within a factory, there are degrees of routinization and degrees of mind numbingness. And you can do factories right or you can do them wrong. Mm. And mostly we've done them wrong.
The key there, actually, in that example, is that what they gave the workers was agency.
And exactly.
Agency turns out to be hugely important in terms of how satisfied people are with what they do.
Hugely important. You know, there's another example I write about in the book of these hospital janitors, and they are the lowest of the low in the hierarchy of a hospital, you know, the people who mop the floors and empty the trash. And most of them just punch a clock and do their tasks and go home. But some of them see their jobs as doing whatever is necessary to enable the hospital to achieve its mission. And that sometimes means cheering patients up, calming down the anxious relatives of very sick patients, helping a nurse turn a patient so the patient doesn't get bed sores. None of those things are part of the job description. None of those things do they get compensated for. But they step in where needed because they regard their contribution to the mission as just as important as the contributions of other people who work in the hospital. And the result is they are eager to come to work every day because they think they're making the world better. And they are.
But we have this system where it's not all, but it's fundamentally we're giving people money to do a job and we're treating those people as if that's why they do that job and for nothing else. And
exactly so.
And incentives don't always work, do they?
Incentives don't always work. What almost invariably happens when you create an incentive is that people learn how to meet this criterion to get this incentive without actually meeting the objectives that the criterion was set up to achieve. Incentives in the U.S. to try to improve the educational system, the public educational system, have been an almost total failure. It doesn't make this motivate the students, and what it motivates the teachers to do is teach so that the kids will do well on the tests without regard to whether they're learning. Incentives are a very blunt instrument for encouraging people to do the right thing in their job.
Well, it is clearly not working, because one of the things you do is you quote that Gallup poll, which was conducted over more than 100 countries, 142, I think, found only 13% of us find meaning at work or are fulfilled by our jobs, let's put it that way. What is the answer if money isn't the answer?
I think the answer is, one, people want to be in charge of their themselves when they work. They want autonomy. They want discretion. If your supervisor respects you, they hand you a goal and trust that you'll figure out a way to achieve the goal. They want to be challenged. They want to learn. And most important, they want work that has meaning and significance. And I interpret that largely to mean they want work that improves other people's lives.
That's important, I think, because I was sitting here thinking, well, it's kind of easy to imagine that Barry gets a lot out of his job, much more than just what he's paid. And I know that I get a lot out of mine. You know, I get to meet amazing people and interview people and make radio programs. It's a very creative process. But what about if you're stuck in the factory or down in the mine or, you know, in the call center? That's harder.
It is harder, and I don't want to suggest that every job offers the possibility of extracting meaning, but many do, and I deliberately in the book write about people who do relatively menial things to show that it really isn't us versus them. People like us, the creative types, the white-collar types, we care about all this stuff, and we're able to find it in our work, but the unwashed multitudes, well, you know, you just wind them up and put them in front of their machine and they'll stamp out whatever product and that's all they care about. That's really, it's an insult to the overwhelming majority of people who work in the world, and it's also not true. And the striking thing is that if you create a workplace where the job has these characteristics, autonomy, discretion, control, meaning, it ends up being a more profitable workplace than the one where people are just slogging through doing the same things over and over again. The right way to create a profitable business is to create jobs that people want to do.
Barry Schwartz is the author of Why We Work, and you'll find details on the Best Practice homepage. Just go to RN's website at abc.net.au/RN. For most of us, the time around Australia Day more or less marks the end of the holiday season. Kids go back to school, and you're probably already back at work. So how did that first day go? Did you spring into it like you're in a cereal commercial, all vim and vigour and shiny and happy? Or did you get in and find yourself pretty much knackered after about 2 hours? Psychologist Amanda Johnston is here to help.
It's normal. I think that's the first thing to remember. We are creatures of habit, us humans, and we get into a routine quite easily. And when we get off work for a small break, whether it's for Christmas, a long weekend, or because we've had some time off because of an injury, our body needs time to adjust back into that working routine. Plan and organise your day. Recognise when I get up in the morning, I'm going to be looking at the cupboard and saying, I have nothing to wear, or I don't have anything for lunch, and falling into those bad habits of running by the seat of your pants, running out the door with no breakfast, and then sitting at your computer with 200 emails.
All right. But the first thing you're saying is, don't worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
This is a normal response. Is it a psychological thing, or is there actually a physiological change that happens in our bodies after a couple of weeks of not working?
There's a couple of things. I think you've got to remember your sleep patterns are a really big driver. So when you tend to go into the working routine, you're getting up earlier, mm-hmm. you're going to bed earlier because you're tired, and you're in that routine. As soon as you add the silly season into the mix, which we've all come back from, there's been parties, there's been late nights, there's been a lot of lovely food and frivolity, and it means that we're sleeping in. or we're having a lazy nap after gorging ourselves on a lovely Christmas meal, for example. So we're instantly out of that healthy sleep routine and suddenly in something quite different. If you're not prepared for that, and the first time you set your alarm is your first day back of work, your body's going to be saying, hey, what are you doing to me? You know, this isn't what we've been doing for the last 2-3 weeks.
Do we know what happens to productivity in that first week back? Has anyone ever had a proper look at that?
There has been a few things out there, and they generally say productivity is quite low when you first hit the shelves. And you can understand that. We're trying to get back into that routine. We're talking over the water cooler about how our Christmas was, what we got for our presents, what we did over that time. The other aspect of it, I think, is pure catch-up. You know, when you sit back at your desk and you haven't been sitting in that static position in such a long time and you have got those 200 emails to sort through, your mind instantly groans and you look at it with dread. And so you kind of get into those procrastination techniques along the way as well. So you need to make sure you're taking breaks and shortening the goals instead of sitting there in front of your computer and saying, right, I'm here for the long slog. Make sure you're getting up and moving around because it'll keep the mind active, it'll keep your body active, and it will make you more productive as well.
The thing that I always think about every year when this happens is that I'm in the fortunate position of really liking my job. I like it a lot. Yep. But I still come back every year and go, So how can we, how can you kind of short circuit that process where you get back to liking your job?
I think you need to remember that it is a period of adjustment. And not to make any rash decisions first up. I think if you normalise it and understand this is what you go through every year, every time after a holiday or every time you have a break, it makes it that much easier to deal with. If you realise that it is something that everyone goes through, that it is normal, you can ride the wave and therefore it'll be less of a shock to the system.
All right, well, let's talk. It's a bit late for this year, of course, because we're all back already. But, I mean, how can we prepare for next time we have a break so that when we're coming back, it's not like it was?
I think it's about making it normal. And a lot of people will probably laugh at me, but it's time to plan your next holiday. You need to have something to look forward to. And it shouldn't be this one time a year. Australians are renowned for overworking. We're the only country that has a national go home on time day. Break it up. Take it throughout the year. Whether it's something small and you're staying at home to get a few odd jobs done or you're going to go interstate or overseas, plan those things so you have those milestones instead of having this one time of year where you kind of rise up and crash back down again. Spread it out.
And I suppose find a way of reminding yourself that all of us to varying degrees, and for some of us when we're lucky a lot, work's a positive thing.
It's a really important thing to remember. And I think we forget that a lot of the time. We're always going, oh, excellent, it's Friday. Oh, boo, it's Monday. It's time for holidays. Oh, no, I have to return back. And I think that language is very misleading. Work is actually good for you. And there's an interesting study which tried to quantify it and actually said long-term worklessness has the same health impacts of smoking 10 packets of cigarettes a day.
That's enormous.
That's massive. And it's trying to quantify for us the physical benefits of work, the mental benefits, the social benefits, as well as the financial benefits as well. We have this social network that is derived from our work and the people that we see and the satisfaction we gain from doing something great and contributing to society as well. And it's language that I think a lot of people can't quantify. So trying to put it in a medical term like the 10 packets of cigarettes a day, really hits home for us that this is actually a really good thing for us.
Yeah. You mentioned emails earlier, something I have been wondering about. For me, like many other people, it's really easy to actually track your emails over the holiday. It all feeds into the phone. Is it better to deal with it as it comes up while you're supposed to be on holiday or come back and deal with 300?
I'm a firm believer in work-life balance. So I think you've got to switch your brain off. Throw the phone away, check it. It's still going to be there on the first day.
There's going to be 300 or 400 there on the first day.
There is, but I think you've got to plan and allow for that with your first day. Take it easy. Don't book in your diary on your first day back at work, 5 different appointments, reports, whatever is important in your line of work. Make sure you've got that time for organising and planning. Stop yourself from reacting and start strategising because you'll be able to achieve a lot more.
Amanda, I came back last week. I wish I'd seen you the week before. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Not a problem. Thank you very much.
Amanda Johnston is a psychologist with the Interact Group. And that's it for this first edition of Best Practice. Thanks to producer Mudita Dias and sound engineer Amrita Betancourt. I'm Richard Adie. Thanks for listening.